Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. Career pathways in first aid schools have grown since the state launched the program in 2015 to help address the career part of college and career ready.
They say pathways is having a positive impact. There are indications of improved academic performance, higher attendance rates, lower dropout rates.
Contributor Larry Nagengast examines the impact career pathways are having on education in Delaware. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also hear from the state's Health and Social Services Secretary about growing concerns Delaware lacks enough primary care options. Arts Playlist tells us about the Delaware Symphony Orchestra's upcoming downstate concerts. And Enlighten Me looks at Free Speech Week and how some in Delaware will mark the occasion. It's all next on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Career and college ready is a mantra you hear a lot when you talk to first aid education officials. And one effort to address the career part of that equation is the Career Pathways Program in Delaware schools. Launched under then-Governor Jack Markell in 2015, the Career Pathways aims to give students hands-on career preparation and the opportunity to earn college credits before graduating high school. The program has seen steady growth in just under 5 years, and we asked contributor Larry Nagengast to take a look at that growth. His piece is available right now at DelawarePublic.org, and he joined me this week to talk more about it.
As we noted in the segment intro, Career Pathways aim to get at the career part of college and career ready. Can you give us a sense in broad terms of how it tries to achieve this?
Once upon a time, and that once upon a time wasn't very long ago, many people thought of college ready and career ready being somewhat distinctive terms. But today's reality is that more and more jobs require some form of education beyond high school. So the two terms are really closer in meaning than you might think. Now, in terms of career pathways, what that means is creating courses of study that focus on learning in specific fields, healthcare, business, information technology, engineering, and building a curriculum that combines pathway and standard high school classes with two big add-ons, one a work-study component or an internship with a business partner, and two, one or more dual enrollment classes that simultaneously provide high school and college credits.
Having said that, what does a typical pathway look like? How does it work?
The standard here is a 3-year program, which would be, think of it as an introductory sort of class in sophomore year, more of an intermediate class for the junior year, and then a more specialized offering in the senior year. Schools have the option of building out this curriculum to fill 4 years if they choose, and many broaden the pathway into what they call a program of study by adding electives from the school's regular curriculum. A business pathway, for example, might include an accounting class, but in addition to that, the school might encourage the student to take a math class in statistics, obviously statistics related to business and to accounting. And then in the summer between junior and senior years, or during the senior year, students would have a work study or an internship with a business associated with his or her pathway.
But your piece does note that the idea with this was to try not to make these kind of cookie-cutter curriculums, but at the same time have some kind of standardization. How do they try to achieve this balance?
Well, you know, it's almost as though every program is a little bit different depending upon what essentially what's available out there. Building a curriculum from scratch can be quite a challenge, but in some industries there are already ready-made programs. For example, the National Restaurant Association Educational Foundation has developed a curriculum for culinary arts that is used in many states, including Delaware. Now, in some instances, school districts are allowed to use a curriculum that they have developed on their own. In subject areas where there is no nationally recognized curriculum available and where districts haven't created their own curricula, they're forming groups that are called industry councils. Members of these councils work with educators to identify what students should know and what skills they should acquire so that they can succeed in a particular profession, and then they develop an appropriate curriculum so that the students gain the appropriate knowledge and skills. Now, no matter matter how the curriculum is developed, for each pathway that a school or a district chooses to offer, the Department of Education requires that the school or the district sign an agreement that specifies the title of the classes in the pathway, what students will learn in each class, how their performance will be measured at the end of the term, and what certifications or college credits they will earn for completing the pathway. So essentially, the pathways are going to be quite similar no matter what district they're in. There's a little bit of room for some leeway and discretion within the districts, but there is a consistency here, and there are standards for evaluation so that they are genuinely meaningful education experiences.
A key piece of all this is working with the business community, getting their buy-in to offer the hands-on experience that you've mentioned that's so valuable, and figuring out how to engage the businesses to be involved. How has that worked out so far? Are businesses on board, and are they connecting with students?
Broadly speaking, Delaware's business community is enthusiastic about pathways. I mean, in the past, I think certainly we've all heard businesses complain that high school graduates aren't ready when they graduate to enter the workforce. Now, pathways is really designed to end that criticism by giving students the skills that they need to succeed when they start work, and by giving businesses the opportunity to help shape the curriculum. At the college level, Delaware Technical Community College has worked with key Delaware industries for years to develop academic programs that prepare college-level students for jobs that meet employers' needs. Now, with pathways, this process is kind of filtering down from Delaware Tech to the high school level. And Delaware Tech is part of the curriculum development process, since graduates of many of the pathways programs will be earning college credits that will give them a head start towards earning an associate degree at Delaware Tech. One other thing to mention here as well, the work study isn't the only piece of business participation in pathways. Depending upon the grade level of the students and so on, businesses are participating in job fairs, in career days. They're doing mentoring, they're offering job shadowing. But far and away, the most important piece of the puzzle is having businesses participate in these work study and internship programs.
One district that seems to have done particularly well with pathways is the Colonial School District. Why is it working so well there?
Well, about 10 years ago, Colonial was in a difficult situation. William Penn High School, which for years had been the largest in the state, was losing students to the Votech schools and to a lesser extent to some charters because the community wasn't happy with how well the school was serving its students. Then when Delaware won a share of the federal Race to the Top grants, some of that money came into Colonial, and Colonial used that to embark upon essentially a rethinking of what it was offering at William Penn. What came out of this process was a decision to divide the school's curriculum, much the way big universities do, into three units that they're calling colleges, and one of them is for business, one of them is for the STEM subjects, and one is for the humanities. Now, Pathways came along just as William Penn was finishing setting up these three colleges. Adding the relevant Pathways programs into each unit gave a stronger backbone to the curriculum.
Is there a program or two in Colonial that stands out?
There are 19 pathways now operating at William Penn, and there are four that I can give a little bit of a shout-out to right now. We've talked in the past about how the Colonial District several years back reached an agreement with the trustees of the Newcastle Common and Delaware Greenways to have William Penn students grow and harvest crops on a portion of historic Penn Farm, which is just behind the school. And then that Penn Farm has become the centerpiece of the agriculture pathway, and some of the vegetables and fruits that are grown on the farm make their way not only into the district's cafeterias, where they're served as part of the lunch program, but also into William Penn's culinary program. So in some respects, the culinary and agriculture pathways at William Penn do intersect. Then there's also an intersection between the veterinary students in the ag program and those in William Penn's health sciences pathway, with the health students drawing blood and taking other sorts of samples from the farm animals. Now, in addition, William Penn is one of the few allied health programs in the state to offer a phlebotomy class. This requires a special certification for the teacher, and it just happens that one of the teachers that William Penn hired for the Allied Health pathway was a phlebotomist. So they're able to offer a phlebotomy curriculum, and they're the only one in Newcastle County that's able to do this. Now, finally, we've got the engineering pathway. And again, you know, we talk about these pathways, and very often we're thinking about kids who are not necessarily college bound or going for associate degrees. But you know, in engineering, a lot of kids are, you know, thinking 4-year colleges, masters, and so on. Well, one of the neat things here for the district is that it set up an internship at Dassault Falcon Aviation, which has a repair and maintenance operation at the Newcastle County Airport. Now, last year and this year, a couple of William Penn students have gone over there, and again, on a work-study program. They're earning $10 an hour, working 8 to 16 hours a week, and they're learning about the complex electronic systems inside each of these private passenger aircrafts that are maintained and upgraded at Dassault Falcon.
And Colonial is also extending Pathways Reach now into middle schools. Why are they doing that?
Brian Erskine, who's the principal at William Penn, says the district believes that students shouldn't wait until ninth grade to start thinking about their careers. By sixth grade, he says, you know, they're old enough to start thinking about what they'd like to do when they grow up, and how to connect those interests with the classes that are available to them to help them get where they want to go. So now, to help with that process, Colonial has gone and set up themes for each of its three middle schools. At George Read, there's business, culinary, and agriculture. At McCullough, there are the STEM subjects. At Gunning Bedford Middle School, it's visual and performing arts and digital media and communications. Now, on top of that, this year, Colonial has set up a work-based learning center at McCullough, and students from William Penn, from the middle schools, and the Wallace Wallen School for Special Needs Youth all are going to be using this center to learn more about careers, to meet with prospective employers, and to get short classes on topics that, you know, aren't part of the regular curriculum, things like financial literacy. And classes like that might be taught by nonprofits, or they might be taught by some of these business partners. There are also plans to open up this center in the evening for services to adults in the community.
And the Career Pathways program, as we noted at the very top, is growing steadily. How many more students is it serving now than it did at the start, and how does that compare with the state's goals for Career Pathways?
Okay. Well, the program has grown rapidly. So it started with fewer than 2,000 students in five pathways in the 2015-16 school year, and moved up to where there are about 15,000 students this year in a total of 25 different pathways. We've got pathways programs in 42 high schools. That's spread over 19 school districts and 8 charter schools. The goal for next year is to reach 20,000 students. Now, that sounds a little bit ambitious, but remember, not all these pathways are 3 or 4 years old yet, so they're growing, and interest is growing as well in the schools. And if you get to 20,000, you're talking about serving roughly half of the public high school enrollment in the state in a career pathway program.
Your piece also notes that the first set of pathway students graduated last spring. Any sense, based on that, how well this is working, or is it still a little too early to tell?
Well, I'm going to say it's too early to tell. I mean, you know, the officials I've talked to, and this is both at the Department of Education and also William Penn, they say Pathways is having a positive impact. There are indications of improved academic performance, higher attendance rates, lower dropout rates, but it's not as though anyone has done any sort of a comprehensive study to pull all this together and, you know, look at more than one school in isolation. And at this point, too, we don't really know how many students have found jobs in the desired fields that they studied in, or how many of them might have continued into college on their pathway. So drawing conclusions is going to take another couple of years. There's a lot of business interest in the program. But the fact is, a lot of businesses have more experience onboarding college students than they do teenagers in high school. And in some cases, it's a lot easier to find internships and work-study programs in a small business than it is in a big corporation where you've got to work through larger HR departments and, you know, a lot more formalized procedures and so on. Even with these issues that Delaware is facing and working through, the program is building a good reputation. I talked to Bob Schwartz, who's the Harvard professor who leads Jobs for the Future, which is the national organization that has guided development of Pathways programs in 15 states. Schwartz calls Delaware the poster child for Pathways nationally, and I'd say that that's a pretty strong endorsement.
Thanks to contributor Larry Nagengast for his time on The Green this week. Larry's piece on career pathways in first aid schools is available right now at DelawarePublic.org. And next on The Green, we hear from the state's Health and Social Services Secretary about challenges Delaware faces providing primary care options. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. An op-ed from Delaware Health and Social Services Secretary Kara Odom Walker recently appeared in the Milbank Quarterly, a newsletter from the Milbank Memorial Fund, which seeks to improve population health by focusing on health policy. Walker's op-ed focuses on issues surrounding primary care, highlighting family doctor shortages, which are especially acute in Delaware, and calling for investing in family care practices. Delaware Public Media's Sarah Mueller recently talked to Secretary Walker about the issues she raised in her op-ed and how the First State is addressing them.
Can you start off by talking about the primary care workforce challenges that Delaware faces?
One of the main ways to address health in our state is to focus on primary care needs. Primary care providers help people with chronic disease management, prevention, and wellness. And we know that we don't have enough primary care docs. Many have come out and said that they're really struggling right now to stay in practice, to stay in the models of care that they love, you know, whether that's working by themselves or with one or two other providers, that they're really struggling with trying to stay in business.
Most of the shortages, is it in one particular county?
There are shortage areas up and down the state in Kent and Sussex where you would maybe expect them to be in some of the more rural areas. But we also have shortage areas in the city of Wilmington where there just aren't as many providers. And they're, you know, often those who are providing care to low-income neighborhoods that we just don't have enough physicians.
So I was reading the op-ed and it said that primary care spending was 3-4%. That was an estimate, and that may be an underestimate. Do you know why it's hard to judge the percentage of primary care spending?
We have heard from the Medical Society of Delaware that they estimated that primary care spending in our state was about 3-4%, and that's based on the best information available. But in order to really look at primary care spend, you have to do a couple of things. One is define what you mean by primary care, and two is be able to look at those costs. So we don't have that data available for the most recent year, and one of the legislative initiatives that took place was trying to figure out how we look at that information. How do we collect it? How do we define primary care? What counts as primary care spend and what doesn't? What is primary care? People would say it's, you know, family physicians, internal medicine, pediatrics. Some would include OBGYN and others wouldn't. Some would even include mental health services in the definition of primary care. So I think we need to define the number as it is relevant to Delaware.
Can you explain what fee-for-service is and also why it's not working?
Fee-for-service is the way that we typically pay for medical services. It basically pays for every visit, every test, every surgery, every image that someone has in the healthcare system. This is not just in Delaware. This is across the country. Our healthcare system has grown up depending on these bills per unit of volume. For, you know, if you do more things, you get paid more. But what we have realized in healthcare today is that the more you generate, you're not necessarily making people healthier. And actually, about 30% of what we do in healthcare is considered wasted cost. We're not spending on the things that actually make people healthier or better, have better managed diabetes or stay out of the hospital. So there is a huge effort underway to transform the way healthcare is delivered, to focus more on value and value as defined by health outcomes for a population.
Right now, Delaware is spending 30% of the state budget on health care. I know this is something that you've been working on, is trying to contain costs. Can you talk about kind of your efforts on doing that?
One of the areas of focus that we've had is to change the conversation from paying for things that just increase the total cost of care. What we know that we're, as a state, the third most expensive healthcare spending state in the country, and we're 31st in health outcomes. So in a very unique way, we are adopting a healthcare spending benchmark that will focus on what we're spending and the growth over time. But importantly, we're also pairing that with health outcomes that matter to keep people healthy and, you know, living their best life possible.
And in the op-ed, you talk about Rhode Island, I guess, putting in some curbs in place to try to limit spending, I guess, to 12%. And you say that it's not politically feasible to specify how you get to 12% spending. Why is it not politically feasible?
I'll just clarify. So Rhode Island has committed to ramping up primary care spend to 12% of the total. And every year they're marching closer to that 12% goal because evidence suggests that for places, mostly other countries, that are able to spend 12% of the healthcare dollar in primary care and prevention, that people are healthier. And so Rhode Island has taken this very aggressive approach where they have said, out of the total, we are measuring this investment in primary care and what we're spending in primary care services. For us, the first step really is being able to even make a statement that is definitive about how much we're spending. We don't even know that. So we need to start at a place where we have good data. Rhode Island is also in a unique place where they have a lot more levers on the total spend than we do in Delaware. So they are able to look at overall hospital budgets and regulate what hospital budgets are. They've done this for a very, very long time. For us, we're still starting that process.
And so what are you most focused on going forward?
We want to make sure that we have a strong foundation of primary care providers in our state. And that really requires an all-in approach from partners up and down the state to make sure that we're training more providers, we're getting more students interested in primary care early on in their medical training, that they have medical rotations and residency opportunities in our state. So the workforce training piece is huge. We also need some tools to recruit docs who train across the country back here to Delaware through loan repayment and other incentives, financial and otherwise, to locate here to start up practice in all different locations in our state. And then we also need to focus on this latter part, which is very much part of, and I don't remember the bill number, but very much part of how we calculate primary care spend. So there will be a longer term process that we need to go through that says, how much are we spending in primary care? How much are we spending in all categories of healthcare? And what do we want to do about it? Is this the right mix and distribution? Do we need to tweak or adjust over time and figure out where there are shortfalls?
Thanks to Delaware Health and Social Services Secretary Kara Odom Walker and our Sarah Mueller for their time on The Green this week. And stay with us. Art's Playlist is next. And it's a double feature this week, looking at the Delaware Symphony Orchestra's planned downstate concerts and an exhibition of art from breast cancer patients and survivors at the Delaware Art Museum. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. This week we offer you a double dose of Art's Playlist, and it starts downstate. The Delaware Symphony Orchestra returns to Sussex County for two concerts this season. The first of those two shows is Monday night, and the orchestra's music director, David Amato, recently spoke to Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele about these concerts, which he says will showcase a variety of music from classical to modern.
The Delaware Symphony Orchestra is returning to Sussex County for two concerts this season. Let's talk all about it.
Indeed we are, and we're super excited about that. We feel like we are the Delaware Symphony, and it's great to be able to be in the entire state.
Are the audiences downstate, before we get in detail about the concerts, are the audiences, have you noticed, downstate different? Do they vary from those upstate?
Gosh, I'm sure they must. I mean, what I see downstate is our audiences that are made of really enthusiastic, grateful, warm folks who seem super pleased to have wonderful music in their backyard.
So where will the first concert take place, and tell me all about it?
So on the 21st of October, just coming up around the corner, at Epworth United Methodist in Rehoboth, in the evening, 7:30, we're going to be playing a string orchestra concert. It's a chamber orchestra concert, and it's featuring three really fantastic works. One may not be so well known to many people. It's a relatively new work by American composer Jennifer Higdon, who's gotten a lot of press in the last couple of decades. She writes very beautiful, accessible, evocative music. We're going to play several movements from a piece of hers called Dance Card. And we'll follow that with a work called The Four Seasons of Buenos Aires by Astor Piazzolla, who is the sort of tango master. He played the bandoneon, which is that sort of cousin of the accordion, and really brought tango music from the dance hall into the concert hall. This is a piece for solo violin and strings, modeled in many ways after the Vivaldi Four Seasons, and it's filled with all kinds of kind of propulsive, sultry tango rhythms and, you know, white hot tunes and lots of virtuosity. We'll be featuring our concertmaster David Southorn for that. And then after intermission, one of the most gorgeous pieces of Tchaikovsky that I know, called Souvenir of Florence. It's a piece that he wrote. It was originally written for a string sextet, and it's been arranged since for string orchestra. Gets a lot of play as a string orchestra piece, and it is, like you would expect from Tchaikovsky, filled with the most inventive melodic genius and an incredible sense of drama. You know, Tchaikovsky is so well known for his ballet scores, and someone who's suited to the theater, I think, is obviously has a knack for writing music that has a kind of narrative drama. And even though this piece wasn't written with a story in mind, it certainly has that kind of drama.
All right, so that's the first concert. We want to remind everybody we're talking to David Amato, the music director for the Delaware Symphony Orchestra. The DSO is returning to Sussex County for two concerts this season. Tell us all about the second concert, David.
Yeah, that's not until May. So this year is a big year in the classical music world because orchestras and chamber groups all over the place are celebrating the 250th birthday of Beethoven. And where would we be without Beethoven, right? So on May 17th, we're going to be doing that celebration as well at K. Penlopen High School in Lewis for a 3 o'clock concert, playing Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, his last symphony, maybe his most famous, the one that has, of course, the Ode to Joy. At the end, we'll be bringing a chorus along with us from UD, and we'll be featuring four wonderful soloists. The first half, we're going to be playing some music of Johannes Brahms, the Schicksalslied, the Song of Destiny. So it's a wonderful program featuring this fantastic chorus and featuring these wonderful soloists. And, of course, the Ninth Symphony of Beethoven is really hard to beat.
Is this the first time the DSO has worked with the University of Delaware Symphonic Choir?
No. We've worked with them a bunch. We've done a whole pile of things with them during my tenure. I've been with the Delaware Symphony. This is my 17th season now. And gosh, we've done countless things with them. And it's absolutely wonderful to work with them. It's a great group. Paul Head, who is their music director, does a fantastic job. And it's a, you know, wonderful, energetic, engaged bunch of singers.
All right, where can we go to get full program information and information about ticket prices, that sort of thing?
Well, you can go to our website, which is delawaresymphony.org, or you can always just pick up the phone the old-fashioned way and call 302-656-7442.
Thanks to Delaware Symphony Orchestra Music Director David Amato for his time discussing the orchestra's Sussex County concerts on this week's Arts Playlist. And we continue this edition of Arts Playlist at the Delaware Art Museum, which is once again presenting a bilingual art therapy program for breast cancer patients and survivors. The program is called Healing Through the Arts, and the museum's manager of studio learning and creative engagement, Rebecca Howe, says it includes a free art show as well as a free reception Sunday. Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele recently talked to Howe about the program and the art produced across the state for this show.
This program originated with our Connected series, which is a series that we have where we ask community members to propose a program at the Delaware Art Museum, and we will give space and a budget for it. And this was proposed by actually a former staff member. And it became a signature program after that. We realized that there was a need that we could easily fill. Working with breast cancer patients and survivors, that's also just expanded to cancer patients and survivors in general, as well as their support people.
Yeah, Delaware, October is Breast Cancer Awareness Month, so this is great. Healing Through the Arts is a free celebratory reception and art show. Let's talk about the show and the reception.
Yeah, sure. So the show consists of artwork that has been made throughout the year at different locations throughout Newcastle County. So we have worked with the Cancer Support Community of Delaware, the Helen Graham Cancer Center, and the Breast Cancer Coalition, as well as an online support group. And we've been offering free art therapy workshops to them. Participants spend some time together. Oftentimes they do bring their support person, the person that supports them throughout their cancer journey, and they make art. So that has ranged from ceramics projects here at the museum to a beautiful woven watercolors workshop, as well as some paint night style workshops as well. After those are done, we collect the artwork and hang them professionally in the museum and have a reception to celebrate.
All right. Tell everybody where the reception is, when the reception is.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's here at the museum on Sunday, October 20th from noon to 4. Not only will we have the artwork hanging, but we will have our labyrinth walks going on. We will have an introduction to something called a slow art tour. We'll have some art making activities and a grief drumming workshop.
Is everyone invited to this event?
Yes. So particularly the people who have participated in these workshops in the past, but it is open to the public and we encourage anybody to attend.
How important, especially during Breast Cancer Awareness Month, how important, Rebecca, is this bilingual art therapy program for patients and survivors?
Yeah, so what we discovered over the past couple years is that Spanish services, our language services in Spanish, are not really available as much as services in English. So we have seen people who don't get to participate in other forms of therapy attend these workshops. It reaches out to a whole new population of people and lets them know they're not alone.
Anything else about this that you want the general public to know about?
I just want them to know that we have recognized this as a need in our community, and we look forward to expanding this program to different locations around the state, but also that we're starting opportunities here at the museum every other month. We have the next one coming up on November 24th, an opportunity called a slow art tour, where you slow down, look at artwork, discuss it in the museum's galleries, and then go over to our studios and do a meditative drawing exercise. This is a program that is free, and we look forward to 2020, where we're offering it every other month.
Talk to me, last question, talk to me about the online support group called In This Together.
Yeah, so it's a Facebook group, and it's been really exciting having the museum be the brick and mortar place where they can actually meet in person. As I said, we've been going to different locations around Newcastle County where services are provided for cancer patients, but we hadn't hosted anything at the museum yet. So Maryland to New Jersey. People who are craving, contact with other people and other forms of therapy. And we've been really proud to be a place where they can meet and do something creative together.
Thanks to Delaware Art Museum Manager of Studio Learning and Creative Engagement, Rebecca Howe, and R. Kelly Steele for joining us on this edition of Arts Playlist. And we wrap up The Green next with Enlighten Me and a look ahead to Free Speech Week. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. Free Speech Week is this upcoming week. The annual event was started in 2005 with the goal of raising public awareness about the importance of freedom of speech and press, and to celebrate those freedoms. The University of Delaware is among those participating in Free Speech Week, and in this week's Enlighten Me, we sit down with UD Associate Communications Professor Jennifer Lamb, who specializes in First Amendment issues, to discuss free speech and what's happening on UD's campus as part of Free Speech Week.
We'll start kind of big picture. Everyone thinks they know what free speech means, but how much do they really understand it and things like freedom of the press and the things that spin off of free speech?
There's a lot of evidence that people can't name what the First Amendment freedoms are, for example. But if you ask people in general whether they support freedom of expression, some 98% of people say that they do. But when you start to ask people things where there are specific scenarios and there are other things that are being balanced against freedom of expression, then people are much more willing to sort of limit or restrict freedom of expression.
Having said that, aside from weeks like Free Speech Week, what can be done to better educate people about free speech, free expression, and its importance?
I think there's a couple of really key things. One is that in high schools and middle schools, there really needs to be an increased curriculum, not only about freedom of expression, but also just about sort of the basic tenets of democracy overall. I think there also needs to be an increase in the explicit teaching of how to have a difficult conversation with somebody that you disagree with. We've for so long told people to just avoid talking about politics and religion, and I think that's just made us really bad about talking about politics and religion. And yet these are things that people care very deeply about, and so we need to be able to have conversations about these things.
That gets to the whole issue of civility. How big a piece is that? The ability not just to respect people's freedoms, but to do it in a civil way.
Right. I think it's really crucial to learn how to talk about something that you have a lot of passion about without demonizing the other side, and to try to truly understand where they're coming from. And that's become really difficult in, I think, you know, our current media environment makes that even more challenging than it has been in the past, because due to algorithms and the ability to personalize your own sort of, you know, where you are, you've got this opportunity to only hear things that you already agree with. And so if we don't have the opportunity to hear the other points of view, how can we have, or we can't even agree on the same set of facts, how can we have any kind of productive discussion, and how can we move forward as a society if we can't even discuss these things?
Beyond that, are there some other particular challenges you see to free speech, free expression, free press that you see as particularly threatening these rights in this country?
A couple of things. I think that hate speech and sort of really sort of extremist speech online is a really big challenge right now. And I know that a lot of people want the government to step in and do something, and I think that that really is a mistake. Except in some very limited circumstances. So the second thing that people kind of go to is, well, then Facebook and Twitter and the platforms need to do something. I'm also sort of uncomfortable with that. I think that they do need to have a role, but if you think about the logistics of how they do that, it's basically using algorithms to identify problematic material. But the algorithms have all kinds of problems that make it so they, first of all, don't identify everything that they should identify, but they also do identify things that they should not identify. So, for example, YouTube was going to take down everything that was sort of white nationalist, but in addition to taking down some of that, they also took down things that were about the history of World War II and Nazis and that kind of stuff, you know, educational stuff. And so the limits of what algorithms can do are pretty limited too. So I think there are a lot of things in terms of education, in terms of advocacy, in terms of some very clever sort of individual level things that people do to try to deal with the negative effects of hate speech that also still respect the rights of freedom of expression.
When you talk about the algorithms and what social media platforms can do, Does it give you some pause then when you see in a presidential debate a Kamala Harris saying Twitter should shut down President Trump's Twitter feed? Does that give you a little pause?
It does make me uncomfortable. I think that the way that the platforms are enforcing the rules that they have put together, it's very hit and miss. It makes me uncomfortable if they're going to restrict, if they're going to make decisions about restricting political speech in particular. I find that deeply troubling. On the other hand, I also find it deeply troubling that people can intentionally put out things that are false. And so I don't quite know what to do. I wish I did. I'd probably make a lot of money.
I want to dig into some other things a little bit deeper. But before we do that, yep. We mentioned that it is Free Speech Week next week. UD is doing some things associated with that week. Just tell us a little bit about some of the events that are happening here at UD and what you'll be doing to use this week to educate people about free speech issues.
Yeah, so there are two sort of pieces that we're doing. One is we've had a partnership with PEN America. PEN America is a group that supports the rights of free expression rights of writers around the country. And that's writers of any kind, from fiction to journalism. Their campus free speech director, Jonathan Friedman, will be coming to campus and doing workshops. He's going to do one workshop with students and student leaders, and then he'll be doing actually a couple of workshops with the professional staff in residence life and in student life. So I'm very excited about that partnership. And then through that partnership with them, PEN America is actually partnering with Index on Censorship this year to do a campus free speech tour. And they together have worked with us to bring in Safa Al-Ahmad, who is a documentary journalist who is originally from Saudi Arabia. And she's done work on Yemen in particular and has produced documentaries for the BBC and for PBS.
Is it in some ways, do you think, really informative to show people the challenges that others elsewhere have exercising these rights? Does you feel like that goes a long way to maybe helping people better understand how valuable the rights they have here in this country are? So when you bring someone in who's covering things in Saudi Arabia and Yemen, where it's a lot tougher lift, do you think that helps maybe people get a little context about what they actually have in this country?
I do. I think I've noticed even from my classes that I've taught, when you can give students an example of how a journalist might be persecuted or even put in jail for doing something that in the United States would be perfectly acceptable and legal, it does make them sort of pause because they're so accustomed to the way that it is in the United States that they don't maybe fully appreciate what we do have in terms of the First Amendment guarantees.
I want to talk about some specific examples of things that are kind of in the news now and just get your takes on those. Let's talk a little bit about something even close to home in Wilmington. City Council President Hanifa Shabazz filed a complaint against a resident recently who's been especially outspoken at council meetings and actually had him arrested. She cited his past disrespect and a, quote, violation of FCC regulations, suggesting that her physical well-being was threatened. The man himself concedes he had used profanity at the meeting, but a number of people, including some of those on council, worry this would have a chilling effect on speech. What do you see when you see a story like this?
Honestly, I think it's a little ridiculous. I don't know a whole lot about what he said before he was banned from speaking. I do think it would be perfectly legitimate to have a time, place, or manner restriction. So maybe give him 5 minutes or ask him not to swear or those sorts of things. I think those sorts of restrictions would be fine. But to ban someone from speaking altogether at an open public forum run by a government body, that seems to me to be about as directly contradictory to the First Amendment as I can imagine. I don't think it's a good idea to ban somebody entirely. And from what I've read, while he may have been unpleasant, it was not a direct threat to do anything to a specific person that was imminent. So I don't think it was a good idea to ban him.
And then to have him arrested, it kind of takes another step further, right?
Having him arrested was absolutely ridiculous. I can't even imagine why the police agreed to do it, frankly. Beyond the pale.
Earlier this week, there was a lot made of a graphically violent parody video that depicted a likeness of President Trump shooting and stabbing opponents and members of the news media. It had been on the web for over a year, but in this case, interestingly, it was shown at a free speech conference at a Trump resort. How worrisome are these type of things in terms of threatening free speech, and maybe kind of getting the balance between speech, protecting people's right to do things like this versus what impact these things might have?
Yeah, I think this is part of a larger pattern, unfortunately, of Trump and Trump supporters attacking journalists. And so I think to understand people's reactions to it, you have to recognize that it's not an isolated incident. And so, and that there has been actual violence against real journalists in the United States and against Washington Post reporter Jamal Khashoggi, and the United States has not really forcefully responded to that. And so I think within that context, the reaction, the horror at this video was understandable. Again, I don't think there's anything that you should do to ban it, but you know, the First Amendment doesn't keep you from having consequences for what you choose to do. It allows you the right to do it. It doesn't allow you the right for people to think, oh, yeah, that's fine, and not say anything back to you. So I think the response, the condemnation, is perfectly legitimate. Do I wish they hadn't showed it? Sure. But I don't think that anybody should ban them from showing it.
And I guess that brings me to the point of trying to find that line. Like, where is that line where something is, as we've talked about in some other situations, beyond the pale versus just something that you may find offensive but still has protections?
That's a very, very tricky question. Generally, the Supreme Court has held that unless there's the imminent threat of physical violence, then the speech has some, you know, First Amendment protection. But again, there are things like time, place, manner restrictions that you can use as long as you're applying those in a content-neutral way that are permissible. I think in terms of the line between offensive and something that should actually be censored, it really does have to be a very narrow band of things that can be censored, just frankly because I don't trust governments to apply that in a way that leaves them more discretion. I know that in other countries the ways in which those things have been applied, sometimes they're used to actually limit people who are in the minority from speaking out about the majority, and that to me is it's worth a little bit of uncomfortableness to avoid the possibility of that happening.
I want to finish on something that's really kind of what seems to me a real gray area. The NBA has had a real issue with China after one of its general managers tweeted support for Hong Kong protesters. Then China pushed back, putting the league in this position of trying to balance its players and executives' free speech rights, which they generally have been very liberal with, and its international business interests in building a market in China. Is this kind of a quiet threat to speech when these two things kind of bump up against each other?
I think so. I think that it's a very, very, again, very tricky line to walk. You can understand why the NBA would want to protect their business rights. But on the other hand, telling a general manager that he can't speak out about the Hong Kong protests seems to me to maybe be a little too far for a business. Again, I don't think that the government should step in to do anything, but I do think that the NBA is legitimately receiving some criticism for telling people not to, not to speak out about in support of Hong Kong.
Thanks to UD Associate Communications Professor Jennifer Lamb for enlightening us this week. And that's all we have time for on this week's edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, you can also check out The Green via podcast at our website, on Apple Podcasts, and on the NPR One app. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible, contributor Larry Nagengast, and Delaware Public Media's Sarah Muir and Kelly Steele. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Burns saying thanks for joining us, and we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.